Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling something that, well, it can feel like navigating a maze: insurance.
It really can. It's complex stuff.
Yeah, so we've gathered a range of materials covering everything from your everyday property and casualty policies, you know, to the more complex commercial coverage, and even some surprising bits you might not expect.
Right. And our goal today is pretty straightforward. We want to pull out the crucial information, the insights that genuinely make you well-informed.
Without getting bogged down in, like, endless details.
Exactly. We're aiming for those key concepts. Maybe a few surprising facts make it make sense.
Okay, so let's dive right in with something loads of us run into: renting a car. Those loss damage waivers, LDWs, they push at the counter.
Ah, yes, the LDW or CDW, always a question.
Well, saying no to one, especially from, say, budget, can put you in a really tricky spot. Our sources say you could be liable for, this is a quote, all loss or damage to the car, regardless of cause.
Regardless of cause. That's intense.
It is. Think about it. Not just the dented fender, but also the rental income they lose while it's off the road being fixed.
A loss of use, yeah.
And admin fees, towing, storage, the works. And apparently, budget doesn't even do a partial waiver. It's all or nothing.
Wow. So that simple decline carries huge weight. That's a key takeaway right there. The sheer liability you might be taking on.
Huge. Now, compare that to another big name, National. They seem to offer a couple of options for LDW.
Right. I think they have a full waiver and then something called LDW2. It covers damage over, what, the first $3,000 or something?
Exactly. Which just goes to show how different these policies can be, even from companies doing basically the same thing.
It really pays to know what you're signing.
And here's where it gets interesting. Our readings suggest insurance agents often actually recommend buying the rental company's LDW or CDW.
Oh, really? Even if it costs more?
Well, not necessarily because it's the cheapest, but because it can make handling a claim way easier.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're, say, traveling somewhere your own insurer doesn't have local adjusters.
Ah, I see. So it's about convenience and process, especially when you're away from home.
Exactly. That ease of handling things, you know, when you're maybe stressed out on a trip, that can be a big plus.
Definitely. Last thing you want is a complicated claim process while traveling.
But hang on. Because that CDW, the one that seems so straightforward, can have some hidden traps.
Okay, like what?
Well, for starters, many have exclusions for what they call careless driving. And one source rightly flags this as a potentially dangerous exclusion.
Dangerous how? Because it's vague.
Precisely. It's so open to interpretation. You know, someone else gets to decide if you were being careless. That feels risky.
Yeah, that ambiguity is definitely concerning. What's careless to one person might just be normal driving to another.
And there's more. Some CDWs only act as excess coverage over your own personal auto policy.
Meaning you have to claim on your own policy first.
Potentially, yeah. Or at least prove your own policy doesn't apply before the rental company's waiver kicks in. Which sounds like a hassle.
Definitely sounds like extra steps you don't need.
And get this. A lot of these agreements exclude damage if you drive on unpaved roads.
Seriously? Like a gravel road to a cabin or something?
Exactly. How many people even know that when they're quickly signing at the counter? That lack of awareness about these kinds of limits is a real issue.
That's a big one. You just assume you're covered, you pay for the waiver, and then find out a dirt road voided it. Wow.
We even have a case study that hammers this home. A client buys the CDW. Later, his friend drives the car just in the hotel parking lot after having one glass of wine with dinner. Causes some damage.
Okay. Friend was allowed to drive.
Yep. Listed as a permitted driver on the rental agreement. But the rental company denied the claim.
Why? Because of the wine?
Partly, yeah. Alcohol use. And you guessed it, that super broad careless driving exclusion.
Ouch. Even in a parking lot.
Even in the parking lot. It just shows how vital it is to understand those exclusions, even when you think you're fully covered.
Absolutely underscores reading the fine print, or at least asking about Q exclusions.
Okay, let's shift gears. Let's talk about something surprisingly common. Home-based businesses.
Ah, yes, the rise of the homepreneur.
Exactly. And according to one source, these are a massive part of the economy. Real business incubators, they call them. Huge potential there.
They really do. They fuel a lot of innovation, lower barriers to entry for entrepreneurs.
But here's a statistic that floored me. 58%, nearly 6 out of 10 home-based businesses are uninsured.
58%? Wow, that's high.
And get this. Of those uninsured, 87% don't even realize they need separate business insurance. They think their homeowner's policy covers it.
That's a huge, huge coverage gap and a really dangerous assumption.
Totally dangerous, because your standard homeowner's policy, like an H03 form,
which is the most common type, covering the building and structures on an all risks basis minus exclusions.
Right. That policy has real limitations for business use. Like, if you run your business mainly out of a detached garage, that structure might have very limited coverage, or maybe none at all, for business purposes under a standard H03.
And the liability side is even tighter, usually. Most homeowners' policies specifically exclude liability for injuries or damage related to business activities conducted from your home.
So, if a client trips over your rug on their way to your home office,
your homeowner's policy probably won't cover their medical bills or a lawsuit if it's tied to the business visit.
Exactly. Now, there are some exceptions, like incidental office use.
Yeah.
Maybe you just do some paperwork at home.
Right. Or maybe running a small school or giving private lessons from home. Sometimes that's carved out.
But the lines can get really fuzzy. And courts have looked at some fascinating cases trying to figure out what's business property versus personal stuff.
It becomes very fact-specific, doesn't it?
Totally. Take this case, Esbury v. Indiana Union. Guy who worked at a mill also hunted for sport. Had, like, over 100 animal pelts stolen.
Okay.
Insurance company said, nope, that's business property, it's excluded. But the court actually disagreed. They looked at the specifics and said, for him, hunting and skinning was really more of a hobby.
So the court really dug into the details of his activities. They stressed it's all about the facts in each case.
But then you have Mac v. Nationwide. A musician had about $27,000 worth of gear stolen. Gear he used for paid gigs.
Okay, that sounds more like business property.
And the court agreed. They upheld the business property exclusion. The homeowner's policy only paid a tiny amount, maybe $500, under the limited business property coverage.
So clear link to income generation and the exclusion sticks. That makes sense.
So if you are running a business from home, what's the fix? Well, there are things called home-based business endorsements. HOBIZ, for short.
Right. These are add-ons to your homeowner's policy.
Exactly. They extend some coverage for the business, but even HOBIZ endorsements have limits, usually maybe up to 3 employees, gross receipts under a certain amount, like $250,000.
And sometimes restrictions on what kind of business, like maybe no making food or personal care products at home unless it's, you know, a recognized national brand, perhaps?
Right. So they help, but they're not a magic bullet for every home business.
Definitely a good starting point for many, but you have to know the limitations.
What do they typically cover? Well, your business stuff, computer, desk, that kind of thing, business personal property.
And some liability.
Yeah, some business liability. Bodily injury, property damage if someone gets hurt on your property because of the business. Maybe personal and advertising injury, too.
Can you add things like coverage for products you sell?
Often, yeah.
Mm.
Products and completed operations might be an optional add-on. But here's a really crucial point. HOBZ typically does not include professional liability.
Ah, E&O coverage. Errors and omissions.
Exactly. So if you're a consultant, accountant, therapist, whatever, working from home, you almost certainly need a separate E&O policy for claims of professional mistakes. The HOBZ won't cover that.
That's a critical distinction. HOBZ handles some risks, but not professional negligence.
And you can usually add other bits to a HOB, like coverage for vendors if you sell at craft fairs, maybe slightly higher limits for valuable papers.
And there are alternatives, right? Didn't AAIS have its own version?
Yeah, the American Association of Insurance Services. They have their own home-based business endorsement, too.
Hmm.
So there are options, but it really depends on your specific business needs.
It's all about matching the coverage to the actual risks of your business.
And here's a huge takeaway, especially if customers or clients ever come to your house for business reasons.
You need more liability coverage.
Absolutely. You really need excess liability coverage. Usually that means getting a personal umbrella policy.
That extra layer of protection over your home and auto policy.
Exactly. High liability limits, just in case of a big lawsuit. Because having people come to your home for business, that definitely increases your liability risk.
That umbrella can be a lifesaver if something serious happens.
Now, umbrella policies, they can be sort of standalone or following form.
Okay, what's the difference?
A standalone policy has its own set of rules, terms, exclusions. So if you have a home business, you've got to really scrutinize a standalone umbrella for any business-related restrictions.
Whereas following form...
Following form generally just adopts the terms and conditions of your underlying policies. Your homeowners, your auto, which can be good if you already have that HOBZ endorsement on your homeowners.
So it aligns better.
Often, yeah. And ideally, our sources suggest, try to get your umbrella policy from the same company that writes your homeowners. It just helps keep things consistent.
Minimizes the chance of weird gaps between policies. Good advice.
Let's move on. Another area with lots of confusion, tenants insurance. You know, for renters.
Right. Sometimes called homeowners contents policy or HO4.
Yeah. And the number of renters who actually have it is surprisingly low, often because of a couple of really common myths.
Definitely some widespread misconceptions out there.
Myth number one, it's too expensive.
But it's usually not, right?
Not at all. Our sources point out it often costs less per month than a few fancy coffees. Seriously. And you can often lower the premium by choosing a slightly higher deductible. It's generally very affordable protection.
It's a small price for potentially saving you thousands if something happens.
Myth number two, and this one's huge. My landlord's insurance covers my stuff.
Wrong. So wrong. That's probably the biggest misunderstanding.
Absolutely. The landlord's policy covers the building, the structure,
hmm.
and their liability as the owner. It does nothing for your personal property as a tenant.
So if there's a fire, their insurance rebuilds the walls, but your furniture, clothes, electronics, that's all on you unless you have renter's insurance.
Precisely. Critical difference, which is why that tenant's policy, that HO4, is so vital for anyone renting. It covers your personal belongings, much like a standard homeowner's policy does.
And it provides liability coverage for you too, right? If someone gets hurt in your apartment.
Yes, exactly. Liability is another key part. And another quick point, older college students living off campus often mistakenly think they're still covered under their parents' homeowner's policy.
Usually not the case once they establish their own separate residence.
Right. Once you're really living on your own, you generally need your own tenant's policy.
It's an important step towards financial independence and protection.
Okay, let's wade into the sometimes murky waters of flood insurance.
Always a tricky one.
Here's the biggest myth of all. Standard homeowner's policies do not automatically cover flood damage anywhere in the country.
That's probably the most critical thing to understand. Homeowner's insurance excludes flood, period.
And the media often focuses almost exclusively on the National Flood Insurance Program, the NFIP.
Right, the government program.
And its coverage limits, which is important. The NFIP is vital. Mm. But that focus can sometimes make it seem like those limits are the only option.
Obscuring the fact that there's a private market, too.
Exactly. What often gets missed is the availability of private flood insurance. And these private policies can offer much higher coverage limits, sometimes called excess flood coverage.
So you're not always stuck with just the NFIP limits?
Not always, no. Private flood insurance is a real alternative. Unlike the NFIP, private companies underwrite each policy individually. They assess your specific property's risk, aiming to cover claims and, you know, make a profit.
So the terms and pricing can vary more than with the NFIP?
They can vary quite a bit. Terms, conditions, even whether it's available in your area. And big events like Superstorm Sandy definitely impacted the market, made some insurers maybe pull back a bit.
Sure. Major losses make insurers reassess their risk appetite.
But the key point is, in many, many cases, private flood insurance is available. And it can often come with broader coverage options and definitely higher limits than the NFIP. So it's worth looking into.
It's about knowing all your options, NFIP and private market.
And for anyone wanting to really understand their flood risk and the options, our sources point to the NFIP's official website, floodsmart.gov.
Floodsmart.gov. Good resource. Lots of educational material there.
Definitely. Really valuable for getting a handle on flood insurance.
It's the official source for NFIP information.
Okay, let's pivot again. Let's talk about something maybe more relevant for folks with higher value homes, collections, that sort of thing. Personal risk management services that go beyond just selling an insurance policy.
Yeah, the value add services. Moving beyond just indemnification.
Exactly. It's kind of like that build it and they will come idea, but for insurance. Insurers, especially in the high net worth market, started realizing they could offer more.
More of a holistic approach, focusing on loss prevention, not just payment after a loss.
Precisely. Loss mitigation,
yeah.
Enhancing family safety. It's less about just the financial transaction, more like an active partnership in protecting the client's assets and well-being.
Shifting from reactive to proactive.
So what kind of services are we talking about? Things like collection management, experts advising on how to store, display, ship valuable art, jewelry, wine, whatever, vulnerability stuff.
How's help with sophisticated home security systems, too?
Right? Yeah, expertise in security tech. Even threat assessment services mitigating risks like kidnapping or extortion, which are unfortunately concerns for some.
And I think I read about specialized driving schools.
Yes. One insurer offers access to advanced driving programs like BMW School and Tech to help prevent distracted driving. Really specialized stuff tailored to those unique risks.
Addressing risks that go way beyond a standard policy.
But even if you don't have Picassos on the wall, our sources stress the value of a simple home contents inventory.
Oh, absolutely. Crucial for everyone.
It's such an overlooked step, but having that list, photos, receipts if possible, can make a huge difference if you ever have a claim, even a small one. Just speeds everything up.
Makes documenting your loss so much easier. Highly recommend it.
Now let's tackle something a bit more philosophical, but really important. The value versus the cost of insurance.
The price versus the worth. Tricky.
We all know the cost, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the premium. Easy. But the actual worth. That's about the quality of the coverage, how well it performs when you actually need it.
It's the peace of mind, the financial backstop when disaster strikes.
And our sources argue that the insurance industry's marketing often focuses too heavily on just the cost, the premium price.
Potentially distracting from the actual value, the coverage details, the claim service quality.
Exactly. That intense focus on price can lead people to overlook crucial differences in what the policy actually does or doesn't cover.
You might grab the cheapest option without realizing you're sacrificing important protection.
One source even brings up the Geico Gecko. Quoting an expert who suggests the Gecko is meant to distract consumers from the business side, the side that impels companies to exploit consumers' ignorance and emotions.
Wow, that's a strong take. Basically saying the cute ads overshadow the substance.
It suggests that, yeah, that focus on branding might keep us from digging into the critical details of the coverage itself. It's part of that tendency to simplify, focus on price.
But price isn't the whole story. Far from it.
There was that one ad campaign, though, really smart. Just 8 words. Who insures you doesn't matter until it does.
Ooh, that hits home. Because it's true. When you have a major loss, that policy is everything.
Everything. It could be the most important thing you own at that moment. So you absolutely have to think beyond just the premium cost. Consider the long-term implications, the actual protection you're buying.
A bit more thought up front can prevent a lot of pain later.
So how can we as consumers, you know, get better at this? Have better conversations about insurance?
Good question. Where do we start?
Well, first, ditch the jargon. ACV, extended replacement cost, APIP. What does it even mean to most people?
Right. Actual cash value versus replacement cost is a big one. Needs plain language.
We need clear, specific terms people can actually relate to. Clear communication avoids confusion, avoids disappointment when a claim happens.
Bridges that knowledge gap. Absolutely.
Second, and this is vital, document the differences between policies. Don't just compare the limits on the summary page.
Dig deeper. What's not covered? What are the exclusions in that cheaper policy?
Exactly. Show people the potential gaps in those save money now options. It's illuminating. Helps them make informed choices.
Highlighting exclusions is key to understanding the real scope of coverage.
And finally, insurance pros should offer more than just policies. Talk about non-insurance strategies. Risk avoidance, maybe just not doing the risky thing. Loss control, taking steps to minimize potential damage.
Show value beyond just selling a product. Be a true risk advisor.
Yeah, it shows they're really invested in helping you manage your overall risk, not just collecting a premium. Builds trust.
Positions them as a partner, not just a vendor.
Okay, let's hit another potential blind spot. This one for condo owners. Loss assessments.
Ah, yes. The condo association levies an assessment on unit owners.
Exactly. Happens when the association has a big loss. Maybe storm damage to the whole complex, and the cost exceeds the master policy limit.
The shortfall gets divided among all the unit owners.
Right, so you as an individual owner could suddenly owe thousands for a loss affecting the entire building.
It can also happen if the loss is caused by one owner's negligence, right? Like a kitchen fire spreading.
Yeah, and maybe the master policy deductible gets passed on to that negligent owner.
Yeah.
Now, the standard condo policy, the HO6.
Typically has pretty low loss assessment coverage built in, maybe $1,000.
Often just $1,000, yeah. And even if you pay to increase that limit, the coverage for assessments related to the master policy deductible is often still capped, frequently at that same $1,000.
So very limited protection for potentially large assessments leaves owners exposed.
We saw some scary examples. A condo complex insured for $5 million gets hit by a tornado, costs $8 million to rebuild. That $3 million shortfall assessed to the owners.
In a 100-unit building, that's $30,000 each.
Exactly. Or imagine a drowning at the pool leads to a $4 million judgment against the association. Again, potentially huge assessments per unit.
It's a significant risk condo owners absolutely need to be aware of and insure against properly.
Let's talk trailers and motorhomes for a second. Liability coverage isn't always obvious.
How so?
Well, if your auto policy covers you pulling a trailer, that liability usually only applies while it's actually hitched up.
Okay, what about a motorhome policy?
That's typically broader. Covers liability whether you're driving or parked. But, and this is the key gap, neither policy generally covers liability for injuries or damage that happen on the site where the vehicle is parked.
Ah, so if someone trips over your awning at the campsite.
Probably not covered by the auto or motorhome policy itself. That's a specific potential gap.
So where does that coverage come from?
Interestingly, your homeowner's liability coverage might step in. It often extends worldwide for personal liability.
Even away from home.
Yeah, but specifically for situations like short-term rentals of sites, think trailer parks, campgrounds, or even long-term vacant land you own or rent.
Huh. So your homeowner's policy might provide unexpected protection in those scenarios?
It might. Shows how policies can interconnect sometimes.
Okay, no.
Now, what if you need more liability protection than your basic home, auto, or boat policies give you?
That's where the umbrella policy comes in.
Exactly. Personal umbrella insurance. It's that extra layer of excess liability coverage sitting on top of your underlying policy limits. Gives you a bigger safety net for major lawsuits.
Because those underlying limits, maybe $300,000 or $500,000, can get used up fast in a serious injury case.
Really fast. Medical bills, lost wages, legal fees. It adds up. But an umbrella policy giving you an extra $1 million or more in coverage.
It's surprisingly affordable, isn't it?
Often incredibly affordable. Our sources compare the cost to just a few fancy coffees a month. It's a relatively cheap way to get a lot of extra protection.
The peace of mind alone is often worth the premium.
Ever feel like your insurance policies are just a random pile? Collected over time, maybe from different places.
Hodgepodge, yeah. Happens easily.
That's where the idea of a personal risk manager and doing a full insurance audit comes in handy. Think of the risk manager as someone looking at the whole picture.
Making sure everything works together, no gaps, no overlaps.
Exactly. They take a holistic view. Common problems they find. That hodgepodge of policies, maybe no single person really understanding the whole program, inadequate coverage here, maybe too much there, overlooked risks, maybe just wasting money on stuff you don't need.
Sounds familiar for a lot of people, probably.
The main goals of an audit are pretty clear. Make sure you have adequate coverage for your big risks, get the right specific endorsements for your unique situation, and make sure you're paying competitive premiums for what you get.
So optimize the protection and the cost. Makes sense. It's a full review to spot problems and inefficiencies.
Now, what about hiring help around the house? Say, a home care aide. You might think classifying them as an independent contractor saves money, avoids payroll taxes and whatnot.
Seems like a cost-saving move on the surface.
But it could open you up to huge risks. If that aide, hired as an independent contractor, gets seriously hurt working on your property.
They could sue you directly for negligence, right? Since there's no workers' comp covering them through you.
Exactly. You could be facing massive bills for medical expenses, lost wages, pain and suffering. Hundreds of thousands, potentially.
Whereas if they were an employee and you had workers' comp.
Then workers' compensation insurance would typically be their primary remedy. That's why getting workers' comp is so critical when you employ domestic workers, regardless of how you classify them. It protects both you and them.
It's a crucial safeguard against potentially crippling liability. Don't skip it.
Okay. Spring showers bring, sometimes, groundwater damage. And here is an almost universal truth in homeowners insurance.
Water damage from below ground level is generally excluded.
Bingo. Sewer backups, water seeping through the foundation. Standard policies almost always exclude that. Catches so many people off guard.
It's a type of water damage that standard policies just aren't designed for.
So what can you do? Insurance-wise, look into sewer backup coverage. It's often an add-on, usually with its own lower limit, but it's something.
And coverage for some pump failure, maybe?
Yeah, that's another potential add-on. And non-insurance-wise, if you have a sump pump, get a battery backup. Essential for power outages.
Proactive steps are key. Backup systems are a smart investment.
And if you're in a really high-risk area for groundwater, or maybe a sump pump isn't practical, federal flood insurance, the NFIP, might actually be worth considering.
Even if it's not coastal flooding.
Yeah. Sometimes it can cover flooding from heavy rainstorms if it causes surface water issues. premiums can be surprisingly reasonable compared to the cost of uninsured water damage. And flood insurance covers groundwater intrusion more broadly.
So NFIP could be an option even for non-traditional flood scenarios.
Good point.
What about using services like Zipcar? Does your personal auto policy cover you?
Good question. A lot of people use car sharing now.
Generally, yes. Most personal auto policies have automatic drive other cars coverage. It usually applies on an excess basis, meaning Zipcar's insurance pays first, then yours kicks in if needed.
And that regular use exclusion doesn't apply. Typically not with Zipcar, because you're using different cars each time. It's not like borrowing a friend's car constantly. So your personal policy usually acts as a backup.
Provides a safety net, which is good.
Now, Zipcar does have its own primary insurance, but it likely has a deductible, and they could potentially deny coverage if you violate their rules, an authorized driver, prohibited use, etc.
So having your own coverage as backup is still smart.
Definitely. If you have collision and comprehensive on your own car, that often extends to the rental. If not, you might look into an umbrella policy that specifically covers damage to rental cars you're responsible for. Just extra peace of mind.
Ensures you're protected no matter what happens with the rental company's insurance.
Here's a really smart tip for managing your insurance. Try, if possible, to consolidate everything home, auto, boat, umbrella with the same insurance company.
Keep it all under one roof. Why is that so beneficial?
Several reasons. It streamlines everything, reduces the risk of gaps. For instance, if the umbrella insurer raises its required underlying limits.
The minimum coverage you need on your home and auto policies.
Right. If they raise those requirements and they also write your home and auto, they can often adjust those underlying limits automatically in their system. Keeps you compliant.
Avoids that nightmare scenario where your umbrella doesn't pay because your underlying limits were too low.
Exactly. It also reduces the chance of agent errors and omissions. And even if you can't use the same company for everything, at least try to use the same agent for all your policies.
Why the same agent?
Helps avoid inconsistencies. You know, different definitions of terms, conflicting exclusions that can pop up when you mix and match insurers through different agents. Consistency is really key.
Makes sense. A coordinated program is less likely to have holes.
So what does a really well-designed personal insurance program look like in the end?
What are the hallmarks?
First, adequate limits. Enough coverage to protect you from a truly catastrophic financial loss.
Not just state minimums, real protection.
Second, policies that are properly endorsed, meaning they have the right add-ons to fill coverage gaps and are customized for your specific unique risks.
Tailored to your life, not just off the shelf.
And finally, access to a really skilled, knowledgeable agent. Someone who gets the whole picture, understands all the different policy types you need.
Expertise across the board is crucial. It's about a comprehensive, tailored approach.
And some key endorsements many people should consider. Workers' comp and employer's liability if you have domestic employees.
Crucial, as we discussed.
Properly structured life insurance. Clear beneficiaries. Comprehensive long-term disability insurance, ideally with options to increase coverage later, covering both partial and total disability until retirement, and with cost of living adjustments.
Those are often overlooked but vital pieces of financial security.
And this all comes back to the value of maybe having a personal risk manager, someone overseeing the whole program.
Ensuring balance, adequate limits, no gaps, reasonable premiums.
Exactly. It's often a fee-based relationship, aligning their interests with yours rather than just commissions. They act as your advocate.
Providing objective advice to navigate the complexity.
What happens if your home becomes vacant, like truly empty, little or no furniture, or just unoccupied, nobody living there for maybe 60 days or more?
Your homeowner's policy can change significantly.
Big time. Coverage for vandalism and glass breakage might just disappear completely. And the insurer might even cancel your policy or refuse to renew it.
Because an empty house is a much higher risk for certain things.
Definitely. Finding insurance for vacant homes can be tough, limited options, often much more expensive.
So it's critical to know your policy's vacancy clause.
Absolutely. Understand those restrictions and look for non-insurance ways to manage that risk. Have someone check on the property regularly. Keep it looking lived in if possible. Avoid triggering those clauses if you can.
Regular monitoring is key. Proactive steps help.
Let's get slightly technical for a moment. Causation in insurance policies. How do they figure out what caused a loss? And does it matter?
It matters hugely. It often determines if the loss is covered at all.
Courts often use this idea of efficient proximate cause. Basically, finding the first cause in an unbroken chain of events that leads to the damage.
The main trigger, the dominant cause.
Right. Now, in policies that only cover specific named perils, human negligence is sometimes treated as an exception. But in all risks policies,
which cover everything except what's excluded.
Right. In those, if human negligence is seen as the root cause, it could potentially get around some exclusions. So insurers developed anti-concurrent causation language.
To clarify how they handle situations where multiple causes happen at once, especially if one is excluded?
Exactly.
It's complex stuff.
So a quick history trip. Insurance goes way back. Early risk sharing like bottomry bonds for sea voyages.
Ancient maritime stuff.
Then marine insurance really takes off at Lloyd's of London. Started in coffee houses, believe it or not.
Where merchants and ship owners gathered. Makes sense.
Faced early challenges. Big losses like the Smyrna convoy capture. But Lloyd's got more professional over time, membership rules, fees, etc.
Became the global center for marine insurance.
Fire insurance also developed early on, Nicholas. And policy terms could be surprisingly flexible sometimes. Marine policy clauses were even suspended during things like the Klondike Gold Rush or the Spanish-American War.
Adapting to unusual circumstances.
Yeah. And this era also saw the start of valued policy laws in some places. The industry definitely evolved.
Showed its adaptability over time.
Then came the car, the gasoline can on wheels.
Initially, insurers were hesitant, right? Too risky.
Very hesitant. But mass production Oldsmobile Ford Model T changed everything. Suddenly, everyone needed auto insurance.
And liability claims started piling up.
Big time. That really cemented the need for auto liability coverage. The car just transformed the whole insurance landscape.
Created a massive new market. Absolutely.
And where did umbrella insurance come from? That extra liability layer?
It also evolved from Lloyd's, didn't it? Excess liability coverage.
Yeah, late 19th century Lloyd's. Cuthbert Heath was a key figure, introducing non-marine liability. Early policies were called employer's liability or accident insurance.
And reinsurance played a role.
Definitely. Companies like Excess Insurance Company reinsured Lloyd's liability risks. And Walter Smith at Marsh & McLennan is credited with developing the drop-down coverage idea for excess policies.
So it evolved over time. Did it stay consistent?
Not entirely. Umbrella coverage grew, but then Lloyd's started questioning how broad some policies were, moved towards higher excess layers. This pushed the market towards more concurrent forms umbrellas that lined up better with the underlying primary policies.
A response to changing risk perceptions and market needs. Rich history there.
Okay, shifting to business critical coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Business interruption insurance.
Vital for helping a business survive a shutdown after property damage.
Absolutely. Its purpose is to replace lost income, cover ongoing expenses while you rebuild or repair, help you get back to profitability.
Keeps the doors open, financially speaking, during recovery.
And the foundation for managing this is a solid exposure analysis. Know what you stand to lose. Our sources mention the Aitken-McKee loss scenario as a good way to understand this time element insurance.
Key terms to know. Business income. Extra expense.
Right. Extra expense covers costs you incur to minimize the shutdown, like renting temporary space.
Yeah.
Then there's the period of restoration, how long it takes to rebuild, and the waiting period, like a time deductible, often 72 hours.
And don't forget extended business income.
Crucial. That covers you for a time after the physical repairs are done, usually 30 days standard, but you can often buy up to a year. Gives you time to ramp back up, get customers back.
Recognizes that recovery isn't instant once the building is fixed.
And think about utility interruptions. Losing power, water, internet. That can shut you down even if your building is fine.
Need specific coverage for that. Service interruption.
Yeah, for incoming services, even outgoing ones you rely on. And then there's contingent business interruption.
That covers you if a key supplier or customer has damage that impacts your income.
Exactly. Think supply chain risk. Events like Katrina, the Japan earthquake, Sandy's power outages really highlighted these off-premises exposures.
Interconnectedness means disruptions can come from anywhere. Critical to consider.
Service interruption coverage can help with direct damage, like spoiled goods and the lost income. Equipment breakdown policies might offer some too, but often with low sublimits in property policies.
So you need to check policy definitions carefully. Covered utilities, covered perils, triggers.
Absolutely. And use those business interruption worksheets. They are essential for figuring out how much coverage you actually need.
Provides a structured way to estimate potential losses, key for setting adequate limits.
Builders risk insurance, specifically for insuring buildings under construction.
Protects the project while it's being built.
First step, Figure out who has an insurable interest, the owner, the general contractor, GC, the subs. Their interests exist at different times during the project.
Coverage is usually all risks, covering direct damage during construction.
Right, but you also need to think about other costs. Lost potential rent during construction. That's business income. And soft costs.
Like architectural fees, engineering, financing costs, legal fees.
Exactly. Those often need specific endorsements. Key questions for insurers. Who can be named insured? Do you cover time element and soft costs?
What about subcontractors getting their own policies, like installation floaters?
Generally not ideal if the main builder's risk policy can cover everyone. Simpler to have one coordinated policy, avoids duplication, claim hassles. Unless there's no main policy, then floaters might make sense.
Coordination is usually better for complex projects.
Coinsurance, that clause in property and business income policies.
Designed to encourage insuring to value, right? Avoid underinsurance.
Exactly. If you don't insure your property up to a certain percentage of its value, often 80 to 100%, you face a penalty on partial losses. The formula calculates it.
Business income coinsurance is more complex, involving projections of income and expenses.
Right. Projecting net income and operating expenses, minus non-continuing expenses. Extra expense coverage usually isn't subject to coinsurance, though.
Can you get rid of coinsurance?
Sometimes. Waiver endorsements exist. Or inflation guard endorsements help keep limits adequate over time. Homeowners' policies often have that 80% rule, too, for full replacement cost. Understanding coinsurance is vital to avoid nasty surprises.
It's about ensuring adequate limits and avoiding penalties.
Mold damage.
Right.
Commercial property policies often include some coverage, but usually with sublimits.
And it usually requires the mold to result from direct physical loss or damage that's otherwise covered.
Yes, but how courts interpret that direct physical loss requirement can vary. We saw that Universal Image case.
Where coverage was denied because the mold was in the landlord's part of the building and the tenant couldn't prove damage to their own insured property?
Exactly. The court took a very limited view of direct physical loss and tangible damage in that mold context.
Shows the importance of proving a direct impact on your insured property. Details matter.
You know, a lot of coverage disputes aren't really about ambiguous policy wording. They're about a lack of understanding unmet expectations.
People assume coverage that isn't actually there.
Right. You have to understand the limits before a loss. The best policy isn't the cheapest. It's the one that covers the loss like you thought it would. Risk treatment starts with identifying exposures.
And coverage can vary so much between insurers, even for seemingly similar policies.
So true. Proactive understanding is key. Avoid those unpleasant surprises.
Know what you're buying.
Standard ISO property forms have some useful extras. Debris removal helps pay to clear damaged property debris.
Usually part of the overall limit may be a 25% sublimit plus the deductible.
Typically. Covers debris of covered property caused by an insured peril. Doesn't cover pollutant cleanup, though. That's separate. And estimating debris removal cost is tricky.
Then there's that pollutant cleanup additional coverage.
Yeah, limited amount, often $10,000 for extracting pollutants from land or water if caused by a covered loss.
What about new buildings or property off-site?
Temporary coverage for newly acquired constructed property with time and type limits. And a property off-premises extension, usually limited to $10, specific location restrictions. Valuable but limited extras.
Good to know they exist, but understand the limitations.
Equipment breakdown insurance. Used to be called boiler and machinery.
It's a named perils policy, right? Complements property exclusions.
Exactly. It covers specific breakdown perils excluded by property policies. HSB's freestyle policy is common. Key definitions. Accident, the covered perils, and covered equipment, the insured objects.
What kind of accidents does it cover?
Things like mechanical breakdown, electrical damage, certain explosions, internal events in boilerless engines, bursting cracking of pressure vessels.
But it has exclusions, too.
Oh, yeah. Excludes gradual stuff like deterioration, corrosion, wear and tear. Also, latent defects, faulty design workmanship, unless they cause a covered accident. And excludes things property policies also exclude, like flood, earthquake, vandalism.
So it fills specific gaps, doesn't replace the property policy?
Precisely. There are helpful tables comparing property policy exclusions with the equipment breakdown policy's covered perils. Shows the distinctions for fire, explosion, electrical mechanical breakdown, pressure vessels. It's crucial gap-filling coverage for businesses with key equipment.
Protects against sudden, accidental breakdowns not covered elsewhere.
Unfortunately, insurance fraud happens. We saw that Williams case trying to claim for property that didn't even exist. Clearly fraudulent.
Straightforward fraud.
Then Hansen v. MetLife. Material misrepresentation on the application hiding who really owned the vehicle. Policy voided based on the concealment fraud clause, even if maybe unintentional.
Underscores the need for total honesty when applying for insurance. Misrepresentations can kill coverage.
Insurers have a duty to pay claims promptly. But look at Buckley Towers. Insurer delayed the actual cash value ACV payment.
Which prevented the condo association from making repairs needed to get the full replacement cost value ACV.
Sure. Right. The court upheld the contract, no RCV without repairs first. But a dissenting judge argued the insurer shouldn't benefit from its own delay that prevented performance.
Raises questions about good faith and fair dealing when payment delays hinder recovery. Potential for inequitable outcomes.
Crime insurance. Two main forms, loss sustained versus discovery.
Key difference is the trigger, right? When the loss occurred versus when it was discovered.
Exactly. Loss sustained covers losses occurring and discovered during the policy period or extended discovery. Discovery covers losses discovered during the policy period, no matter when they actually happened.
So switching to a discovery form might cover older, previously unknown losses.
Potentially, yes. Especially if the discovery form has broader terms than the old policy. Premium difference is usually small.
Yeah.
Worth understanding that trigger difference.
Determines the look-back period for coverage. Important distinction.
And in crime policies, who is the named insured is critical.
Only those listed or covered by an omnibus clause get protection.
Right. If you have multiple related companies with crime exposure, consider adding an omnibus clause to cover them all. Don't assume coverage extends automatically.
Make sure all exposed entities are explicitly covered.
Setting crime limits. Theft burglary is somewhat easier to quantify cash securities on hand.
But employee theft, forgery, computer fraud, funds transfer fraud.
Yeah.
Much harder to quantify potential loss.
Way harder. No real credible formula exists. Requires careful assessment of controls and vulnerabilities. It's more subjective.
A best guess based on risk assessment.
Be wary of sublimits in policies, even in coverage extensions.
Those pre-printed lower limits for specific types of loss?
Yeah. They might look okay on paper, but prove totally inadequate when a loss actually happens. The cost of inadequate coverage, even from a sublimit, can be devastating. Always check if there are enough for your potential exposure.
Don't just assume the standard sublimit is sufficient.
When renewing policies, think beyond just cutting costs.
It's not just about getting a lower price.
No. Focus should be reviewing exposures, reassessing needs, implementing cost-effective coverage that actually meets those needs. For instance, raising a property deductible. You need to analyze how that impacts debris removal coverage, which is often tied to the loss amount after the deductible.
It's a holistic review, not just a price comparison exercise.
Insurers need accurate property values, replacement cost, or ACV. That's why coinsurance exists, to penalize underreporting.
But valuing contents, especially during manufacturing or assembly, can be tricky.
Very tricky. Use the policy's loss settlement clause, like a checklist, to make sure you're accounting for everything correctly. Accurate valuation is crucial.
Ensures you have the right amount of insurance when needed.
Business interruption worksheets, we mentioned them. Absolutely critical.
For estimating potential lost income and extra expenses, essential for setting limits.
And for calculating coinsurance. Understanding the waiting period impact. And they help you present your claim with supporting documents later. Don't skip the worksheet.
Provides the necessary data for adequate coverage and smooth claims.
Excess insurance policies. They pay after underlying limits are used up.
So the underlying coverage needs to be at least as broad as the excess layer.
Ideally, yes. Following form, excess policies adopt the underlying terms. But if underlying coverage is narrower, you can have gaps.
The excess policy might not drop down if the underlying policy excluded something.
Right. Ideally, the excess policy should recognize the underlying loss, satisfies the attachment point, even if sublimits or exclusions meant the primary didn't pay the full amount up to that point. Alignment is key.
Coordination between layers is vital for seamless protection.
Cyber risk. Huge issue now. Electronic data is critical. Potential for catastrophic loss.
Requires collaboration between risk management and IT. Definitely.
Controls are paramount, firewalls, backups, training. But insurance is tricky. Defining data, electronic data. No standard legal definition often.
A constantly evolving risk landscape.
Standard ISO property policies. They don't handle cyber well. Covered property might seem to include data initially.
But then specific exclusions kick in.
Exactly. exclusions for electronic data, and the cost to replace or restore it. There's that tiny additional coverage, maybe $2,500, only if the media is physically damaged.
And exclusions for viruses? Hacking by employees?
Right. Generally, ISO property policies don't adequately cover cyber exposures, especially for online businesses. Need specialized cyber or maybe inland marine policies?
And no business income coverage under ISO forms if data destruction shuts you down?
Correct. Regardless of cause, physical or cyber attack, bottom line, proactive controls are essential, and scrutinize any policy claiming to be a cyber cure-all.
Standard policies leave major cyber gaps, need dedicated coverage.
Pollution can be first party, your property contaminated, or third party, you cause liability.
Risk controls might overlap, but insurance treatment differs.
Does standard property insurance cover pollution damage or related business interruption? Usually not for accidental spill seepage in ISO forms.
Ordinance and law coverage also usually excludes pollution cleanup costs.
Right. Business interruption needs direct physical damage and often excludes land, foundations impacted by pollution, so you often need separate pollution liability policies for third-party claims.
And maybe first-party pollution policies for broader coverage of your own property cleanup?
Yeah. Need to consider the full cause and effect beyond standard policy limits. Specialized coverage is often necessary.
Pollution requires careful, specific insurance planning.
The appraisal process in claims for resolving disputes over the amount of loss, not coverage itself.
Each side appoints an appraiser. They select a neutral umpire.
Key is your appraiser's knowledge, the subject matter, the process, the players involved. Define the scope early. If coverage is disputed, that might need a court ruling or separate panel findings.
Agreeing on protocols, site inspections, info exchange helps speed it up. Can be effective for value disputes.
When must an insurer pay? Timely payment is expected, but timing isn't always precise.
Policy conditions matter, proof of loss, investigation time.
And the insurer's duty of good faith and fair dealing. Unreasonable delays can lead to penalties, interest, maybe consequential damages if it impacts BI recovery.
Timely payment is a core obligation.
Additional insured endorsements, extending coverage to others,
can be automatic, blanket, or scheduled, listing specific names.
Becoming more scrutinized. Often need a written agreement before the loss for automatic status to apply. We saw that Suffolk Construction case.
And issues arise if contract requirements aren't fully completed, like a GC needing status. But the subcontract insurance section is blank. Documentation beforehand is key.
Interpreting commercial general liability, CGL policies. Got to read the whole thing, including exclusions, to grasp the insuring agreement.
Exclusions don't create coverage, but they define its scope.
Right. CGL covers some liability assumed in insured contracts. If an insurer invokes a contractual liability exclusion, they usually have the burden of proof.
Occurrence and accident, often disputed, especially in construction defect cases, needs fortuity, unexpected, unintentional.
Causal language is huge.
Right.
Caused by, resulting from, arising out of. Courts read arising out of broadly, like before, but need a substantial nexus. Saw that drug overdose case example.
Careful reading of the entire policy, including definitions and exclusions, is crucial.
Basic CGL exclusions to know. Liquor liability with exceptions. Workers' comp. Employer's liability for employee injuries.
Auto exclusion. Owned, operated, loaned with exceptions. Watercraft. Owned. Aircraft.
Damage to property owned, rented, occupied, sold, loaned. And your care, custody, control. Damage to impaired property. Product recall costs.
Pollution. With exceptions. War. Damage from electronic data. Distribution of material violating statutes. These carve out major areas.
Let's use that Ches Richards scenario. Restaurant uses temp staff from Wait With Us agency. Agency provides workers' comp.
Waitress Lisa gets hurt at the restaurant, sues the restaurant. Cher Richards.
Cher Richards' CGL insurer denies, citing the employee exclusion. Says Lisa is a leased worker, included in the employee definition.
But CGL policies distinguish leased from temporary workers, right? It matters which definition applies.
Exactly. And what about the agency's employer's liability insurer? Might they deny coverage if Ches Richards seeks it, arguing Lisa isn't Ches Richards' employee?
Potential for insurers to argue opposite definitions depending on who is seeking coverage. Having it both ways highlights the complexity of defining employment status.
Let's shift to ethics. Agent Bruce knows his clients, the Kellys, are likely facing foreclosure, bad credit. Should he deny them homeowners insurance based on that, even if the insurer, Ajax, might approve it?
Tough ethical spot. His options. Insure normally, insure with conditions, or reject as a bad risk.
Puts the listener in his shoes.
Yeah.
What are his responsibilities? What's ethical when selling insurance in difficult financial situations? Tension between client need and underwriting reality.
Raises deep questions about an agent's role in judgment.
Another one. Agent Aggie finds out her contractor client, Conrad, finished a church kitchen job but didn't report it for coverage.
Aggie's first thought, maybe Conrad thinks not reporting saves premium, seems like risk management.
But it's not good risk management, and it's unethical. Why? Conrad lacks liability coverage for that completed job. It damages trust with the underwriter, SIC. It's adverse selection against SIC.
Ethical action. Aggie reports it belatedly, secures coverage, bills Conrad, reinforces that good insurance is part of good risk management. Transparency is key.
How should the industry respond to our changing world? More severe disasters, terrorism, climate change concerns.
Regulators might want quick fixes, short-term mandates.
But the industry needs patience, a long-range view. Insurance principles rely on equitable, adequate, reasonable premiums based on risk classes, long-term models.
Need to differentiate insured versus uninsured losses, hurricane wind versus flood. Need time to assess losses, adjust premiums reserves thoughtfully, a measured approach.
Using credit scores and auto rating. Insurers say lower scores correlate with more claims, maybe because less cash for minor damage.
But does correlation justify higher premiums without proof of lower scores cause more accidents?
Exactly. Critics say insurers need to make a clearer case for using credit scores. Fairness debate continues.
Touches on fairness and the predictive power of credit scores for driving risk itself.
Accident forgiveness. Consider Johanna, Jeff, and Lillian. Multi-car crash. Jeff, insurer A, has forgiveness, lower premium despite poor record. Other Jeff, insurer B, gets free forgiveness. Lillian, insurer C, has no forgiveness, clean record, rates creep up.
Fundamental principle, rates, adequate, reasonable, fairly discriminatory. Does forgiveness violate that?
Arguably, yes. Overcharging safe drivers, Lillian, to subsidize riskier ones, Jeff A. Insurer C's traditional approach seems closer to principles. Insurer B risks attracting too many bad drivers if forgiveness is free.
Ethical concern, betrayal of trust, financial harm to safe drivers, unintended consequences.
Ethical claims dilemma, Toto tornado hits. Claims manager Grant must prioritize claims from a hospital, vital, community center, charity hub, historic restaurant, landmark, jobs.
All have strong cases for community importance. How does Grant choose? He recalls greatest good for greatest number.
But how to apply that here? Who is the greatest number? How to measure good? Highlights the immense ethical complexity of prioritizing critical claims after disaster.
Forces incredibly difficult choices with huge community impact.
Risk manager ethics. Justin, Smithfield Homes, learns foreman's reckless boating incident involved using the boat for paid transport, initially unknown. Boat not owned by Smithfield.
Coverage issues arise. CGL likely excludes owned watercraft, maybe non-owned, used for a charge. Justin has dual duty, stockholders' interests, and utmost good faith to insurers.
Dilemma. If a later payment by Principal Sam Warbucks to victims negates coverage, must Justin disclose this if he didn't know initially? Non-disclosure could be material misrepresentation, breach of good faith. Honesty, transparency, vital for long-term trust.
Highlights potential conflict between fiduciary duty and good faith obligation to insurers. Tricky ethical ground.
Where do ethics come from? Fundamental principles of right wrong. Sources vary. Upbringing, life experience, religion, discussions, philosophy.
No universal consensus due to diverse sources. Think of hiding a fugitive parent family loyalty versus law societal order. Conflicting principles. We'll explore more specific risk insurance dilemmas later.
Confidentiality. Core ethical duty for risk insurance pros, especially proprietary info. Justin again, has confidential fire safety info from competing trash clients, Bob and Frank.
How does he handle that? What procedures exist for managing competing clients' proprietary info? Strict confidentiality is paramount.
Special knowledge, special duties. Do risk managers with expertise have a higher ethical standard to act on observed risks, like a doctor in an emergency?
Scenario. Clothing wholesaler's risk manager sees fire hazards at neighboring paint maker in same industrial park. Paint maker has no safety officer.
What are the manager's duties? To their client, wholesaler. To other tenants, park management. Advise wholesaler, maybe inform park. Ensure client's insurance is adequate. Special knowledge arguably creates broader ethical obligation to act.
Conflict. Tenants' right to operate versus others' right to safety. Park might not grasp full financial risk. Heightened responsibility seems likely.
Bottom line, good risk management and good ethics are intertwined. You need both. Unethical acts undermine risk management. Poor risk management can lead to unethical outcomes.
Misrepresenting info to underwriters jeopardizes long-term protection. They are mutually supportive, essential.
Personal ethical dilemma. Speaker needs daily aids. Potential aid Pam is great, but has long, hazardous commute. Approve Pam.
Balancing Pam's need for work, speaker's need for care versus Pam's commute risk. Not right versus wrong, but right versus right. Benefits and harms on both sides. Complex personal calculation.
Standards for insurance producers, agents, brokers. Scenario. Nationwide agent discourages flood insurance despite FEMA recommending it. What standards apply?
Sources. Case law, insurer manuals, occupational standards, licensing, ethical plans, conduct imperiling license, misrepresentation, fraud, unfair trade practices, rebating, twisting, false ads, unfair discrimination, violating laws, ATA, etc.
Advertising regs, including websites, important. Codes from CPCU, NAHU, IIABA, NAIFA. Insurer agency internal codes. Professional designations, CPCU, CIC, ARM, might imply higher standard. Multiple layers of standards exist.
Aiming for competence, integrity, client focus.
The debate. Are producers true professionals, like doctors, lawyers? Judicial model often says no, more like skilled occupation, no ongoing duty to advise with that special relationship. Impact standard of care, use of terms professional, client.
Dissenting view. They handle complex matters, require expertise, should be seen as professionals with higher standards. Advocates re-examining liability based on expertise, a conflicting duality.
Agent liability, E&O. Morrison's life insurance application. Agents incorrectly answered driving violation question without confirming. Morrison signed without reading, relying on agents.
Later find violation making policy contestable. Court holds agents liable for failing to get the requested incontestable policy due to their error. Client's reasonable reliance on agent expertise was key. Contestable policy due to agent error, failure to procure.
Stark reminder of agent responsibility in applications. Due care and accuracy are critical. Liability can result from errors.
Underscores the importance of accuracy and thoroughness and the consequences of agent mistakes.
So wrapping up this deep dive, key takeaways. We saw the risks with rental car waivers, the gaps for home businesses, the need to understand flood options beyond NFIP, the value of real risk management services.
And the ethical threads running through it all, plus agent responsibilities. Hopefully a few aha moments without too much overload. We covered a lot of ground.
Definitely. So our final thought for you today. Take a fresh look at your own insurance. Really consider the nuances we talked about. Do you truly understand what's covered and what's not?
Are you relying on assumptions that might not hold up? It's worth that proactive review.
Absolutely. This deep dive is just a starting point, really. Feel free to send questions. Keep exploring. Becoming truly informed is an ongoing process. Thanks for joining us.